Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fucking ears? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I'm broadcasting from beautiful downtown Manhattan now. I'm way downtown. I'm Lower East Side downtown. I've moved from Midtown to downtown. Today, the weather, I'm looking out my window. It's fucking stunning. It's fall. It's crisp. It's clear. Leaves are changing on the trees that are sort of dotting the streets here in Manhattan. And as always, after I stay here for a little while, I realize what an amazing and successful experiment Manhattan seems to be on the level of humanity. Just all types of different people coexisting up against each other all the time with a seeming amount of brash politeness. It seems that people who live here and people that visit here sort of know the dynamic between the two. You see sort of strange groups of foreign tourists and people from other states, kind of wandering around in awe, somewhat stoned-ish just by the overwhelming nature of New York. And then you see New Yorkers just kind of mildly but aggressively moving through the crowd. There was some, you can feel, not tension, just sort of like, hey, what you know what I mean? When I'm trying to get by here. What are we doing? What are we doing? Huh? Little bit of that. Tomorrow's a day. Yeah, I think that I'm having a hard time focusing right now because everybody needs to vote. And I think most of you who listen to this show understand that. I think that it's the best shot we have at having any hope. Look, we have a problematic two-party system in this country at this juncture in history, and those two parties are us and them. And that's the way it goes on either side. And the fact that it's so strangely, almost evenly split in terms of these poll numbers is disturbing and implies that maybe it's not going to be over on Tuesday. Maybe it could go on for weeks with recounts and weird accusations and conspiracy theories. I don't know, but I know that I hear the word decency a lot. I hear people on TV saying, let's a return to decency. And I think that's a reasonable thing because being decent is not about righteousness. It doesn't mean you're a good person. It just means you behave properly within the context of treating other people with respect. The one fundamental thing that democracy needed to sort of move forward was a certain amount of tolerance. And that was just too much for people. A tolerance of diversity, of potential. It was too much for too many people to handle. And once that, they ripped that need to tolerate off, we've just opened up this portal to the worst fucking behavior and the worst ideas that human beings are capable of. And certainly everybody's capable. Everybody has it in them to be intolerant and shitty because of their own fear, their own insecurities, their own lot in life. But to have all those things stoked up and to have all this fucking violence and insane hatred, it's just like it's so fucking uncomfortable and just goddamn scary. So I hope some movement is made tomorrow in the direction of maybe reining a little bit of that in. I don't know if we're going to get it all back. I don't know if we ever will. I don't know, honestly, if this country is ever coming back. But it would be nice to have a little hope tomorrow that things can move in a direction where decency, tolerance, moral behavior, inclusion, you know, starts to sort of make a little headway. But tomorrow's the day. So do us all a favor, will you? Vote. There are a few tickets left for my Saturday night show at the Beacon in New York City as part of the New York Comedy Festival. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for the ticket link. That's actually this Saturday, November 10th at 7:30 p.m. And if you're at the Beacon show, you'll have the first chance to buy the new WTF t-shirt, which was designed by Aaron Draplin. We'll have a limited number of those for sale at the Beacon, and then they'll be going on sale in the merch store. But it is kind of wild to be down here on the Lower East Side. I'm literally very close to Katz's Delicatessen. And it was funny because with all this violent anti-Semitism that is happening around the world and in this country, when I get down here, when I'm on the Lower East Side, I do sort of really connect with American Jewishness, with what I come from, with you know, New Jersey, with just the whole journey and my sort of weird appreciation of at different points in my life of everything that was part of that American Jewish experience. I just had an interesting experience with, you know, walking out to go do some comedy spots at the Cellar the other night. Some guy comes running out of Katz's Deli. He says, "I'm a big fan. I do my own podcast. I want you to be on my podcast. I work at Katz's. You know, why don't you come in tomorrow? You know, tomorrow morning, we have breakfast. I can make you like a, you know, lox, eggs, and onions, and we could talk a little bit." This guy, Dave, from, I think the podcast is Dopey, it's called. And, so I thought about it. Usually I'm sort of like, really, am I going to do that? But, you know, he sort of got me, you know, I got into that brain. It's like, I'd like to have a reason to go sit in Katz's and, you know, sit in that sort of timeless vessel of American Judaism and cuisine, a very specific thing. I worked in a deli when I was in college, the last Jewish deli in Boston, Gordon's Deli. And, you know, there's always been something about, you know, old Jews that sort of informed my comedy and informed the way I think about things from a very young age. Like on Thursday, I'm going to have Buddy Hackett's son on the show. Oh, by the way, today I'm going to talk to Rita Rudner, another Jewish comedian. But I got up the next day and I went over there. And, you know, I had some lox, eggs, and onions, and I sat in Katz's, which seems like it hasn't changed in 100 years. And apparently I thought it went through some bad periods, but no, it's back and it's very popular. It's the only place in town where you can get the sort of hand-cut corned beef and pastrami and brisket. And, I had a lox, eggs, and onions. Yeah, I'm still doing the diet thing, but I really needed to taste the meat. So he had the cutter give me a little sampling of the brisket, of the corned beef, of the pastrami. And it's just, it connects me to something historical and something that is, you know, very deep in my identity. It's just, there's something about being on the Lower East Side. There's something about being in New York that brings it out of me. You know what I'm saying? I've been doing sets down the Village. It's been awesome. I've been seeing my old friends. Spent some time with Dave Attell the other night. I saw who was there last night. Me and Todd Barry. Todd Barry wandering the streets. The last two nights I've walked from the Village back down to the Lower East Side with Todd Barry, and it just reminded me that almost 30 years ago, me and Todd Barry had a hard time getting booked in many of the bigger clubs when we were starting out in the city, and we would wander around the streets just talking about why we couldn't get booked at some of the clubs in the city. 30 years ago, I can't believe it's that long. Man, I must have learned something in 30 years. It's very strange. Especially when you don't have kids, so you can't see, you know, your life passing before your eyes in the form of another person growing up. But you know, I see Todd, and we're just kind of wandering around, and it's not even nostalgic. It's just sort of nice that there are these relationships that you have that you may not maintain, but you know each other for a long time, and you just sort of step right back into it. And there we were walking around, talking about comedians, talking about clubs, talking about where we're at in our lives and wandering the streets of New York 30 years later, almost 30 years later. So I got this this email, and I think it indicates something, or it implies something. Not even implies, it just made me think. This subject line is Busy's Dad. "Hi, Mark. when you and Busy, she's talking about Phillips. When you and Busy discussed her father on your podcast, you started riffing on how engineers can be emotionally aloof. I know you aren't stating a hard and fast rule, but I just wanted to let you know that my husband, who has a PhD in nuclear engineering and works as a materials scientist, is a man who hugs his father and his son, who rescheduled work so he could coach 17 seasons of his son's various sports, and who cried every time he read certain books to his children, in particular, First Tomato by Rosemary Wells. He doesn't talk much about his work, but that's because it is classified. Love the podcast. And I started thinking about that, about how, you know, when I make general statements like that, which I do. I make general statements about all kinds of different groups of people. They're generally not ethnic groups, aside from Jews, which I am one. But and I think that gives me license, but I'm not even sure that is true. But I think that I need to qualify things a little bit, because I do make blanket statements about that. And I think that's where people, you know, that's where we get into trouble. I think that I don't even know where it comes from. Well, actually, I do, with the engineer things. You know, we make these assumptions about math nerds or about engineering nerds. And I, you know, certainly I've met some that are, you know, socially a little bit awkward or perhaps emotionally detached. But how many really? How many have I really met? How many do I really know? Yeah, I knew some in high school. I've met some in my life, but we're talking like a handful. And so I make this generalization about engineers and mathematicians, because it makes sense. But I think the truth of the matter is, if I go deeper, it's because I can never wrap my brain around math. Most of my energy went into to being entertaining, or to entertaining other people, to being social, to being a comedian. So I probably have a natural kind of envy or insecurity around people who are able to do mathematics and do whatever her PhD in nuclear engineering husband does. I probably wish I could do that, but I know there's part of me that knows there's no way I could do it. I don't have the discipline or the focus. I never did. I never had the interest. I don't have a knack for it. So anytime you have a lack or a shortcoming or a characterological flaw or inability that makes you insecure, you know, why not judge others that have it in a way that makes you superior? Doesn't that seem to be the problem of just about everything that's going on? Isn't that at the core of bullying, of racism, of almost everything? It's there in all of us. You know, there's something there in all of us. There's very few people that are that together, that are that grounded and that self-assured or comfortable in their skin, that you can't poke at something in there and get a little bit of hate, get a little bit of shitty envy, get a little bit of hostile feelings, get a little bit of judgment. It's right under the surface, apparently, for a lot of people. And that's, where's that coming from? Is that based on logic or intellect or facts of any kind? No, it's based on fear, insecurity, and envy. But I think that's, you know, part of that journey, a threatened sense of self. How fragile is our sense of self? What do you really know about you? Are you who you think you are? This is how I start my day, which I am doing right now. So Rita Rudner is somebody I remember from, you know, back when I was starting out. She was one of the great comics. She was. She is. She's still doing it. She's still doing it a lot, and she's still doing it well. A singular voice. And one of the great comics of her generation. And it was amazing and thrilling to get the opportunity to talk to her. Her new comedy special, A Tale of Two Dresses, is now available on digital and on-demand platforms. You can also check out RitaRudner.com to see where she's performing around the United States. This is my conversation with the amazing Rita Rudner.
How old is your daughter?
16.
Mm-hmm. And you, like, were not going to have kids, or you just...
I couldn't have kids.
Uh-huh.
I can tell you all this. I have no secrets, so I can tell you anything.
Well, you're telling it to me now. We're rolling.
On. Oh, okay. No, I couldn't have children.
Uh-huh.
And we tried for a while.
Yeah.
And I said to Martin, we'd been married for maybe, you know, we got married and then we didn't talk about it because I was doing my shows and he was producing shows in England and Australia.
Yeah.
And we didn't really want to do anything. And I said, you know, I'm getting older here because we got married when I was, I guess, 35 or something, and 34. And he said, I don't want kids either. So then when I'm like around 44 or something, he goes, let's have kids. And I went, well, you know, you should have mentioned this before because it's just not, you know. So I go to my doctor and I took a blood test and she said, you have a 1% chance of ever getting pregnant.
Wait, and was that because of your age or just because?
Age.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, she said. And so, you know, I said, well, you know, I'm not good at math, but 1%, that's not good odds.
Yeah, of course.
So we started talking about surrogacy and I said, I'm not comfortable with that
and hire somebody and his stuff and her stuff
and my stuff is left out.
Right.
And I, you know, I need my stuff.
Yeah.
Either no stuff or my stuff or your, no, it's not going to work like that. So we kind of put it on the back burner.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm riding, coming back once, and he doesn't even know this. So I'm coming, flying back.
Don't tell me you surprised him and showed up with a child.
Yeah, I stole a child. So I'm flying back, and next to me on the plane, I'm flying back from New York, is Ben Stein. And I'm talking to Ben Stein. And
was this when he was an entertainer or a Republican pundit and speechwriter?
Oh, it wasn't. I don't. All I knew is that he was in a game show and
right.
did commercials.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah,
there you go.
No. So, because it was, well, she's 16, so this must be 17, 18.
When he was on Ask Ben.
Yeah, one of the, he was on Comedy Central.
Yeah, Take Ben Stein's Money or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there. He goes, I can't wait to get back to my son.
Mm.
And I said, he's so fantastic. And I said, so I'm starting to talk about children.
Yeah.
He said, adopting a child was one of my favorite things I've ever done. And I said, really, how did you do it? So he explained how he did it. And I made mental notes. I came back and I said, Martin, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
So I
how
called,
did you do it?
I called up the lawyer that he recommended, the adoption lawyer. And we got interviewed. And then he did his lawyer thing that he does when he knows how to put things in ads and people answer them and we do the thing. And then we set, you set up a little separate phone for when you get the call and you talk to people on the phone.
Yeah,
and
set up a separate phone?
Yeah, because it's just like the bat phone.
Uh-huh.
And when the bat phone, phone, it's a
there's
bat phone.
One available. Let's see if we can get it.
Or? No, it's the person who is pregnant.
Oh, right.
And wants to just see if they, you can have a conversation.
Oh, that's how you did it. My brother did it that way too.
Yeah.
So you were talking to people who were already about to have babies.
Yes, and you know, you see if they're, and so this lady called, and we had a conversation, and she asked us to send her some information, and Martin, because he's a producer, so he puts together this brochure of who we are and what we are, and with a big picture of my dog, because our dog is fantastic. Uh-huh. We have a big sheepdog, like a mixed up sheepdog, who's
no
in
DVD?
My act.
A DVD?
It would have been a DVD if he could have done it. So he does this magnificent presentation. We got along great, and we took care of her. It was an open thing, and we took her to the doctor, and we helped her, and we did everything, and we have a lovely girl who's 16 years old now,
and
she's fantastic.
That's great. Yeah, my brother did three kids that way.
Ah.
And do you have a relationship with the mother still, or does she?
No, she wanted to go on her way and do her thing, and we didn't hide. I mean, I'm not hidden.
Right.
I have
a
Facebook page.
Right.
She can contact me at any time.
And you've told, and your daughter knows.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
From the beginning of time.
I got into a little problem recently from a couple of people, adoptive parents, when I asked someone who was adopted if he has any relationship with his real parents, and they got very upset.
Yeah, you know, people say that they don't mean anything by
it. No, but it's, I guess I can see how it would be sort of insulting in a way.
You know what, there's
not
so
you.
Many other things I can be insulting. People have said that to me all the time. What do I care?
Yeah.
I know who I am.
Right, but you're the real parent.
Yeah.
And you guys.
I'm doing vocab with her every night, and I know who I am.
Yeah.
So, she got 100 last week, by the way.
Oh, congratulations.
Not to brag,
that's very nice. Well, you know, it's really great to see you because I've known who you are for a long time.
Well, I've been around a really long time.
I know, but you were like, you're a big comedian.
No, yes. You're very, people say, I say I'm going to do your show, and they go, why does he want to talk to you?
No.
He's in and you're out.
That is not true. No true. One said that. I mean, I still, there is, I try.
Well, I can see when I listen to you, you love comedy.
Yeah.
And you're, and I love comedy.
Well, I was
so,
in it.
Well, I know.
We live in it.
But I mean, I am steeped in comedy, as
yes.
you are steeped in comedy.
Yeah.
Like you say, we're lifers.
That's right.
And I just, you know, that's who I am. I never did comedy where I said, you know, I mean, there were always people in the clubs who said, I'm a lawyer, but
yeah.
I'm doing comedy.
Worst.
I'm this. And you have to say
yeah.
all in.
Yeah.
So
well,
I'm
yeah.
all in.
I have a hard time with people who still talk about their day jobs in their act.
No, you can't have a day job.
What
you have
that?
To spend the day trying to write,
yeah.
Trying to write jokes and then not coming up with something.
That's right. Yeah. Spend
That's
all
how
day.
You have to. And then at the end, then you have two words in your notebook and
yeah.
then you go
yeah.
and you try to make something of them.
The two words or the
oh,
one
my God.
Thought.
Shrapnel. All I got is shrapnel today.
Yeah,
I got to
exactly.
try to make a joke about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I know the. I still carry around the notebook.
I have the notebook too. Yeah.
yeah. And I don't write it on my phone. I don't write it on the computer.
I've tried
compulsively.
You know what? I've started phoning, doing the phone.
But do you check it? I mean, I used the notepad thing on the phone?
Yeah, because.
Or do you talk into it?
No, I can't talk. I'll never find myself talking again.
Yeah.
I have a little notepad, but I accidentally erased it. Because I pressed
on the
something.
Phone.
Yes.
Right, that's the problem.
And Martin had to, because he does things like
yeah.
that, and he had to get it back through all whatever he did.
Yeah.
So now I do double.
Right.
I have the phone and I put it in a notebook.
Oh, well, good. So
yeah.
you got backup.
Yeah.
And let's go back, because like we're Jews, right?
All Jews, yeah.
And today's Yom Kippur.
This
we're
true.
Bad Jews.
Yeah, we're bad Jews. Excellent. Yeah.
So where did you like grow up? Where was your Jewishness
Well, I grew up in Miami, Florida.
Really?
Yeah.
People grew up in Miami, Florida.
Born in Miami,
Both your parents were Miami people?
No, they're from New York.
So they went to Miami.
My father said, I'm never going to be cold again. And
had
he
enough.
Said, and he didn't like his brother's wife who lived in California.
Yeah.
So he went to Florida.
And that's where, did
and
he retire there or he worked there?
He was a lawyer.
In Florida?
Yeah, he was a lawyer in Florida.
And do you have siblings?
No, just me.
Oh, really?
And my mom was housewife.
Yeah.
And my mother was kind of religious. And my father was too lazy to be religious because he was a very lazy person.
Like what kind of? Like kosher kind of?
No, just, yeah. you know, with a lot of this and hard-boiled eggs and Passover.
Oh, you
and
did
my
the
Aunt
Shabbat
Beattie.
Candles
yeah.
and whatnot?
Not only when we went to our Aunt Beattie's and Uncle Moe's.
So,
but
Beattie and
Moe. Beattie and Moe.
Yeah.
But what happened was my mother got very sick and she died. And she was sick most of my life. And she died when I was 13.
Oh, that's terrible.
I know. It wasn't good. So my father, who was very lazy,
yeah.
He looked over here and went, oh, there's a wife. And he married her because he didn't
yeah.
want to look anymore.
How was that one?
Well, she was bad. And she wasn't Jewish. And then we had
what
seven
kind of
Christmas trees. She didn't like me.
Oh.
And she wanted to like start a whole family and didn't want me there. So.
Did they?
No,
oh.
because they should have discussed that before he said, oh, look, there's a wife over there. He
right.
should have said, okay, let's discuss, but he didn't, because
yeah.
he's lazy.
Yeah.
So I left home when I was 15.
And, 15?
Yeah, I moved out. I
what
moved
year
to New
was
York.
That?
I think 1857.
Wow, yeah. things were different then.
No, yeah. yeah.
No, but was it like the 70s or was it like because you like
I was 15. I just turned 65.
Congratulations.
So thank you. I go to Old Lady
yeah.
Disneyland now. I can go on all the e-ticket machines.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yes, and, yeah, CAT scans, MRIs, you name it.
Early bird specials.
Yes, early bird specials. That's me. So whenever that was, because I can't lie about my age because the internet is there. And
no,
it
that's
tells
fine.
Everything.
But I'm just curious about like, you know, a 15-year-old girl departing.
I know, isn't that weird?
Like, was it the 70s? It must have been the 70s.
Well, I was born in 1953 and I was 15, so do the math because I'm not good at math.
So 68. So it was a very
yeah.
exciting time.
I guess.
I mean, did you run away?
No, I took a plane. He bought me a ticket.
Oh, he wanted you out. He
yes.
was like, you seem good enough to go.
He said, what, okay.
With family or were you going to?
No.
Really?
No.
Just here you go.
Yes.
I got it. This one doesn't like you. You got to leave.
She preferred me that I shouldn't be there and I wanted to be a dancer on Broadway.
So you went to New York at 15 in 1968 by yourself?
Yes. And I moved into the Barbizon Hotel for Women.
And what is that?
It was a hotel.
Yeah.
Do you like this story or
Love
not?
It.
Okay, because I don't want to make a bad story for you because you're a very good person.
Oh, no,
okay.
no. I'm just
so they
curious
had little rooms and my
evolution.
Dad subsidized me until
right.
I got a job when I got
well, that was big of him. He threw you out of the house and he decided he'd carry your weight
he
for a little while.
Yeah.
What a nice guy.
Well, it was cheaper than college, you know. So, and I did.
He thought he was saving money.
Yeah, he said, this is a bargain here. So I got, I graduated high school. I skipped 11th grade. I just did 12th grade. I said, I don't want to bother with 11th grade. Yeah. I took extra courses in the summer.
You really wanted out of Florida.
She hated me. She just was a terrible.
Did he stay married to her?
Until she died, too, yes.
No kidding.
Yeah, of the same thing my mother died of. So then he didn't want to get married anymore. But anyway, she was a lunatic.
Right.
And so I wanted to be a dancer. I was already a pretty good dancer, I have to tell you.
Now, like, just real quick, in retrospect, given that childhood and given that relationship, do you think it affected you psychologically?
Absolutely.
How did you track it?
Like,
do you have abandonment things? Or
no. What? I don't know. There are different ways you can use neuroses.
Right.
And I chose a good way to the way I chose, and it wasn't a conscious decision.
Me neither.
It was to keep myself busy.
Yeah.
And tired.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to deal.
Tired's important.
Yeah, tired is
exhaust
really.
Exhaust yourself with anxiety.
That's what I did. No, listen to what I did. So I was so upset about my mother and the things, and it was just awful, and this horrible woman living in my house who tore down my mother's wallpaper and put new furniture in, and I just had to get away. So I decided to be a dancer on Broadway.
But what? Tell me about Barbizon. Why is it for women? Was it safer?
It was only for
women.
Yeah, only women were allowed.
Was it an entertainment thing, or was it
for old, divorcees and young girls?
So women in transition,
or old ladies who never
got
married.
That's transitioning to something.
Yeah, but I mean, it was just what do you call the people who never get married? The
spinsters.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Old ladies.
Is that still a real term?
I don't know. Maybe somebody's going to yell at me for doing that. But anyway, so. It was a little room, and the bathroom's down the hall.
Oh, hall bathroom.
And bathtub is, you had to make a reservation, get in the bathtub. Uh-huh.
And you're 15.
Yeah.
And there's 15. Other 15-year-olds there?
There was one other 16-year-old who was on scholarship with the New York City Ballet, because those are the other kinds of people who were in, because that's ballerinas. They leave home very early to go study in New York.
And their parents are okay. I guess it's okay.
I don't know.
It sounds crazy.
It is crazy. I would never let my daughter do this.
So you had no leads?
No, I just knew that I wanted to be a dancer
on
Broadway.
And you could dance already?
I've been taking ballet, tap, jazz, acrobatics since I was 4.
Well, you look like a dancer.
Well, thank you. I've always been, I love dancing, mm-hmm. That's all I wanted to do. But what I did was I exhausted. I would take ballet in the morning. I would take tap in the afternoon. I would take jazz at night. I would go out to she's shows. I would do that. And I would just, so I exhausted myself. And then I got my first job when I was 16.
Dancing.
The National Company of Zorba. I was a professional.
Who was Zorba?
John Raitt was Zorba, and Cheetah Rivera was the lead.
Ah.
And I went on tour for 9 months with this company, and I was 16 in Zorba.
All over the country?
All over the country, yeah.
And you were one of the dancing girls.
I was the swing girl, and I didn't know what that meant. I wasn't equity when I auditioned.
Right.
So I needed to get into the union, because I went to an open call where thousands of people, and I was so excited. And they said, you're the swing girl. And I actually thought that I had a rope that I used to swing in on, but I didn't know. I said, okay, but I learned everybody's parts, which was great practice and preparation for learning things.
It's so amazing to me that in show business, and I think it still happens today, that wanting to be a dancer was not it was equally as irrational as any decision to get into show business, but it was a profession.
Yeah.
And it still seems to be a profession.
Is a profession. What do you mean seems? It's a profession.
Well, I just mean because I'm saying that your occupational possibilities are somewhat limited.
Absolutely. People, in fact, I had an aunt who said, you're crazy to let your daughter do this. And
because
she
what
has
are you
to
gonna
go
do?
To
you
college.
You got to be in a musical. You got to be in a traveling show. You got to be a Rockette. I mean, sometimes you see the dancers.
The odds were so against me.
Even
ever
more than comedy.
Anything.
Almost more than any other
Well, comedy
show.
Was pretty bad, too, with
right,
the
so,
odds. So, well, but anyway, I just to do briefly. I did 6 Broadway shows. I was on Broadway for 10 years.
And what now, your experience with that, was it thrilling? Was it the best thing that you ever did?
Oh,
did
I loved it.
And you work with great people?
Yes.
Who are some of the people you work with in dancing?
Well,
Cheetah Rivera?
Yeah, Gower Champion. I did Mac and Mabel from the beginning with David Merrick and Gower Champion.
Oh, wow.
And I did Follies on Broadway with Michael Bennett and Hal Prince. And Annie on Broadway with Peter Gennaro, Martin Shornin. And let's see what other shows I did. Magic Show, Groverdale.
The Magic
Stephen
Show?
Stephen Schwartz, yeah.
With Doug Henning?
Well, he wasn't in it when I was in it.
No?
No, but Joe Abaldo was in it, who was a really nice and fabulous guy.
And did you get to see the country when you toured as a 16-year-old?
Yeah, I
Zorba?
Saw the whole country, and I'd never been anywhere.
Were you traveling on a bus?
We planed. It was a national tour. It wasn't a bus and truck. So we did planes. And because I was so young, it was almost as if I had 20 parents looking out for me.
That's good. Was there one creepy uncle?
No.
No.
It wasn't any creepy, but what I did, I didn't have a lot of people who wanted to talk to me, so I adopted a stray dog, and I named her Agatha, and she was, a huge sheepdog, and I took her on the road on the plains, and I had a big crate, I don't know.
Is it another sheepdog?
I like hairy dogs, yeah.
I grew up with Old English sheepdogs.
Well, she wasn't a real, she was a combination Afghan, they said, Afghan and poodle and something else, but she was just adorable. So
were you, did you hit a wall? Or, why did you not keep dancing?
I was in my sixth Broadway show.
Yeah.
And I'd been on Broadway for 10 years.
10 years?
Yeah.
And you were making a living. You had your equity card.
I did really well. I was doing commercials all the time. And I did industrial shows.
Right.
And I was on Broadway. I was doing
industrial shows, trade shows?
Yeah.
You would dance for
the Continental, the Comet, and the New Marquee, the Midsize Montego, and the Sexy Capri. And then there's the Cougar and the Great Mark III, more kinds of cars for more kinds of people. It just doesn't leave you. It
doesn't go away.
No, it doesn't go away.
Everything else goes away, but that's not
going. That's not going anywhere. Yeah. I danced about cheese. About clocks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew how to make a living. I was a singing waitress. I was a coachette girl. You got it. So
after, when were you singing waitress?
In between jobs. You got to figure it out.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So, and it's funny because people have this vision of me. I think because I wear a dress and I stand up straight because I was in dance, that I had an easy time.
Oh, no.
You know?
Yeah.
And they even say it sometimes in comedy when I do things. They go, who writes your material? I do.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a guy in the back who's sitting there with a pencil.
Well, I think some people, as we both know, that there are comics as they get older, do hire people to write for them.
Yes, that's true. However, those are people, I think, who have to produce more material than I have to produce.
Right.
Because if you're on TV every night and the world is changing every minute.
No, I mean like Jimmy Walker, people like Ron White's got a bunch of guys writing for him. I mean, I guess so. I mean, but it's still sort of, I respect it a great deal that you write your own stuff.
I couldn't say it. And people say, oh, here's a joke. You can say, no, I can't say it unless
but
I think of it.
But even people that know you, I mean, you're very unique and you're very stylized.
Yeah.
There's no one that's come up to you and said, I get your voice. Look at these bits.
They've tried and I read what they write and I go, I can't say it. Why
not
would
me.
I?
It's not me.
No, it's got to come from something in my brain.
So
I'm 27. I'm in Annie on Broadway and I'm thinking.
Oh, that's how.
Yeah.
But during these times, New York was a very exciting, sort of menacing, sexy, drug-ridden place in the 70s. And you managed to avoid all that?
There's nothing in my makeup that would go that way. I don't know why. It's not a conscious decision. Again, I just...
Not a party girl.
No.
Yeah.
I like being home. I like reading. I like watching TV. Being with one friend. I like one boyfriend. It's just not who I am.
But you saw it. You must have seen what was happening.
It was downstairs.
Oh, okay.
I stayed upstairs. It's true. So I'm a catch a rising star.
Wait, you didn't get there yet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're an Annie.
But we only have a limited amount of time.
No, I can keep you here as long as you're
willing.
Oh,
good. I don't want to go over my allotted time.
There's no allotted time.
Okay.
But so you're an Annie?
Yeah. And I'm sitting there and even though I went to school and I legally have a high school, graduation certificate, I felt I was not educated. So I used to read the New York Times every day.
Sure.
That was my education.
How did that go? Did you? It's hard sometimes, isn't it?
But I would say, there's got to be something interesting in every section of this paper and I can learn something from it.
Yeah, but do you find if I read about politics, especially about legal stuff, court decisions and stuff, I sometimes cannot figure out whether it's good or bad. I don't know the language and sometimes I do
skip
not
skip over that bit. You just skip over it and you go, what can I get out of what's written here?
Good.
So I would, because I said I shouldn't just look at the arts and entertainment section. I should look at other things.
Yeah, travel.
Anything. There could be a
business.
Place. I'm not saying I read the whole thing.
International.
Yes. You can. You tell me when you finished.
I'm done.
Okay. but it's true. So I said, I'm going to look at an article or yeah. two from each section. Sure. So I'm sitting there. It's between shows and Annie. And I'm looking at the business section. And I read an article about soft soap, which is just being introduced into the market.
Soft soap?
Soft soap.
This kind of squirt?
Yes. Oh. And it had never been introduced before.
And you're trying to figure out a dance number for it?
Yeah, soft soap. I was writing a soft soap song. So I'm going, well, let's see. They say you can either, this is the way you introduce a new product into the market. You can either make the same product and try to make it better.
Right.
Or you can create a new product that has its own individuality. So we decided with soft soap, there wasn't a soft soap on the market, and we were going to go in there, and it was a huge success.
The
instead
hand
of
soap?
Making a bar soap, it was the first soft soap.
Yeah. Okay.
So I said, well, let's see. There are millions of singers and dancers and actresses, and there are only two female comedians that I'm aware of, which were Joan Rivers and Phyllis Diller. So if I can be unique in a female comedic voice, maybe I can get noticed more than if I can turn and kick.
So this all hinged on the soft soap catharsis?
Yeah, yeah, in the business section of the New York Times. So I said, well, let me try to write jokes. So
were you a fan?
I was like a dormant comedy
but
fan.
But like, why out of everything at that moment when you're reading about soap?
Because I tried everything else. I didn't have a boyfriend at that time. I didn't have any money at that time. I was just like making a living on, I said, I've got to wait for someone to write a show,
right.
to cast me.
Right.
I've got to be what they want. The show has to succeed. Somebody has to come to,
yeah.
I said, these are too many obstacles.
Did you go to comedy clubs?
Never before.
Okay, so you, Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers.
I just saw them on Merv Griffin.
Right.
You know,
oh, yeah, Merv Griffin,
television.
Sure. Because you were home a lot watching TV.
Well, because I worked at night.
Right.
And so so I said, let's try to go. So I started going to comedy clubs.
Which ones were around then?
The Improv, because Annie was on
44th?
50th Street, and I would walk down on 8th Avenue to go to
44th,
the Improv.
44th, right?
Yeah,
the original?
44th.
And Bud was still there?
No, Silver was there.
Oh, Bud was already gone?
Yeah. Silver was there, and
that's always
Chris
a party.
Albrecht.
Oh, yeah. Silver is always exciting.
Silver, I have good Silver stories. So,
she's
you want
still
me to
around.
Really?
Yeah.
You want me to tell me? I can do it quickly.
No, we'll stay in the evolution.
Oh, it's going to be so long.
It's not going to be
are,
long.
I'm going to find it in. But are
no,
you sure?
No, this is great. You're
okay.
already interesting.
Okay.
Like,
so,
it's a roller coaster. We're excited. We're on the Rita Rudner ride.
So I go and I say, I start to look at some comedians. And I remember I talked to, he won't remember this, but Steve Middleman. I talked to Steve Middleman.
Steve Middleman. Yeah. With the no chin guy.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
I was a male model.
Yeah.
So I modeled socks. So I go, so I talk to Steve Millman and I say, how much is it to write comedy, to buy comedy material? Because I'd never written a joke.
Yeah.
He said, well, it's going to be, $3,000 for 5 minutes. And
oh, he was going to write for you.
Yeah.
Oh,
and $3,000 for 5 minutes and there's no guarantee it'll work. And I said, oh my gosh, I got to learn how to write comedy. I don't have $3,000 and there's no guarantee it's going to work. This is a bad deal.
Yeah.
So,
real quick though, or not even quick. So when you start going to the Improv, you met Steve Middleman,
mm-hmm.
but like who else was going on? Did you see other
Gilbert,
women?
Gilbert.
Okay, Gilbert.
Gilbert, Judy Orbach, who was
wow.
a singer.
This is at the original Improv.
Yeah,
in the Little Room.
44th Street.
Beautiful, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And Rich, he wrote Sniglets. Rich,
oh, yeah, Rich Scheidner. Rick Hall. Yeah.
And Rick Scheidner.
Scheidner,
Donna
yeah.
Murphy, who's on Broadway now, was a singer.
Yeah.
And
now that's when they had a variety format still? They did have some singers still?
They had some singers, yeah.
And this is like 1980?
I guess. Yeah, about 1980, 81, somewhere uh-huh. there. And so I sit there and I go, oh, okay, let's try and write jokes. And
did you think about dancing too or doing a musical
no,
thing?
No, I wanted to leave that behind. I did that. I did that since I was four.
Right.
It's over. And I was an okay singer, but I would listen to singers audition on Broadway and not get jobs, and they were fabulous.
Yeah.
And I would see actors, and they were fantastic. They wouldn't get work. I said, there has to be better odds than this.
Yeah.
My heavens.
Right.
So
So Middleman's offer did not pique
no,
your interest?
No, I said, no, that's not happening. So I said, how do you learn to write jokes? So I said, who do I like? And I liked Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Because I loved his movies, Take the Money and Run, and he always made me laugh.
Right.
And he had this
that
album.
That one album, the double album.
That's it.
I Shot a Moose.
Oh, so I took that album, and I had a piece of paper, and I diagrammed every joke about where the laugh was,
and
then
how
I
they
tried
were structured.
To think why they were laughing, and then the structure, how the two thoughts came together, and what, you know, and I just did that. Because I lived across from the Lincoln Center Library.
Oh, yeah.
And
so you'd sit there and do that?
Then I could take all the, because they had albums.
Oh, right. You could check the records
out.
Sit there with the headphones or at home.
But I went, so then I said, okay, I'm going to do this. I said, I'll put myself through comedy school.
Mm-hmm.
So then I went to, there was the Museum of Broadcasting, which had just started up.
Oh, that's great. You go rent the you go
and
sit.
And then you sit in the thing. Yeah. So I said, who else did my mom like? My mom liked Jack Benny.
Right.
So I said, okay, let's look at Jack Benny, because I'm not an aggressive person. I'm a like a laid back kind of a shy person. Mm-hmm. So it was meaningless for me, even though, you know, I became friends with Joan Rivers and Phyllis Diller, and I think they're wonderful women.
Yeah.
But their personalities were very aggressive.
Bah, bah, bah.
Yeah. And I was an introverted Jewish girl.
Yeah.
So I decided to listen to introverted Jewish men.
Yeah.
So that's how I started. And then
with Jack Benny, Woody Allen.
Yes.
Who else?
It was, Jack Benny, and he used to have a friend, and they used to go...
George Burns?
Yeah, well, it was George Burns, and I met him, and I did his 90th birthday party, and that was fun. But, no, there was another guy, Allen.
Fred Allen. You went way back.
Oh, yeah, why not? And then, because I lived in New York, and at that point, they had all these great comedic film festivals.
What about Gracie?
I liked Gracie Allen, I did, but I couldn't really relate to... her the degree of
ditziness,
vapidity, is that a word?
Right. Yeah. I think
I made
so.
Up
yeah.
a word.
Yeah.
I couldn't relate, and somehow that people compare me to that anyway. But
they're not listening.
But I just didn't really get that. Anyway, I liked her.
So the film festival?
So then I said, look at all these things I can learn from. And I started going to the Preston Sturges film festivals and the Jacques Tati and Buster Keaton.
Wow.
And Charlie Chaplin. And, you know, and it was just fantastic. It was like a whole world of a whole school I could go to every day.
You built a curriculum for yourself.
I did. I went to my own. And more importantly, I kept my mind busy, so I wasn't thinking about my mother and my horrible, you know, time that I
Sadness.
Had.
Sadness.
Yeah. So instead of exhausting my body, I decided to exhaust my mind.
Sure. And at this point, you're like, what, in your 20s, late 20s?
Late 20s. I changed careers.
Yeah. But I love it, though. Do you find that all that stuff with the intent of doing stand-up, that taking in Chaplin and Keaton and Jacques Tati, do you feel like that informed you?
Hope so.
How could it not?
How could it not? I mean, I can't like put my finger on it and say, oh, this is this, and you know, this is where it came together. But I think it all does. I even started reading books about Sigmund Freud's lessons
wit and its wit
and wisdom. Yeah. And
relation to the unconscious.
Yes.
And so you're getting into the science of it?
I tried, and a lot of it I didn't get. And some of the jokes he said I didn't think were funny.
No.
But I said maybe something will go in.
What about Groucho?
I like Groucho, but again, he was a different personality.
He was a
much more aggressive personality.
So, but ultimately, the bottom line is the joke writing structure was really the ticket.
Yeah.
In,
yeah.
In, you know,
and I sit there and I go, and where is the laugh? Why do people laugh? I mean, that's where I started. And then I had such good friends. I still have really great friends from all of my years in theater and everything in Miami.
Yeah.
And I would leave messages. Is this funny? Is this a joke?
You hadn't gone on yet, but you're driving your friends crazy.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we do.
Oh, all the time.
How about this?
Is this anything? What if I said this? And my friends are like, not yet, Rita. You know. But eventually, I got to a joke, and then I got to another joke, and then
you remember your first joke?
Absolutely.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
What was it?
It was... I broke up with my boyfriend because he wanted to get married and I didn't want him to. That was my first joke. See, it still works. And it ends on a word with two letters in it.
Uh-huh.
And it's a sharp sound.
Yeah,
and I was so excited. I thought of a joke.
He wanted to get married and I didn't want him to?
Yes.
Yeah. it's a Rita Rudner joke.
Yeah, and that was my first joke.
So when did you first go on? How did that happen?
Well, I sat and, you know, I found out that auditions were Mondays and
at the Improv.
At the Improv.
Yeah.
And people would get there early and bring chairs and books and things.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And sit there all day to get a chance to audition.
Yeah.
And my
For silver.
Yeah. And the first time I sat there and I didn't get in. And then I said, okay, I got to get there earlier next Monday or whatever it was. And I sat on the street.
They didn't take numbers. You actually had to wait online.
And there was a line. Catch a Rising Star, they took
the numbers. I remember.
Oh, I first tried Catch a Rising Star when I was in Annie with my friend who was a singer, and we got a number, and we were on at 2 a.m., and we did a singing thing, and that didn't work at all.
Who was the guy in charge of those numbers then?
Mark. something.
Yeah.
I remember Mark, who was very hungover all the time.
Oh, right.
I can't remember his name.
Right.
Last name. Finally, I get into the improv and...
Well, you got 3 minutes?
3 minutes. And I think I had 3 minutes of material and Chris Albrecht passed me and said I could hang out.
So Albrecht was the manager and also...
And I think he was like the manager bartender or...
Yeah.
But I mean,
and then he went on to become...
Now he's the head of...
Epics or... No,
first
Starz.
He was the head of HBO. Now he's the head of Starz.
Right.
But he was very supportive of me. And he was the manager and he passed me and said I could hang out. He felt I had potential.
Mm.
So I would watch the people every night and say, why is this funny tonight and why
isn't this funny? Who are you getting the most
out of? There was a comedian called Ronnie Shakes.
Sure.
And
passed away.
I loved Ronnie Shakes so much. And he had very structured jokes and they were easier for me to figure out.
He was a great comic, that guy.
Wasn't he? I loved him. I still quote his jokes all the time. There was another very funny comedian called John DeBellis.
DeBellis.
Who became a comedy writer.
Yeah.
And I liked his jokes. And I could take different things. But the most important thing, I just thought... The first time I got up on stage, I was funny between jokes.
Right.
You know?
Right. What, on purpose?
No. I was
as a reaction?
As a reaction to them not laughing to what I had said.
Uh-huh.
And I was funny about it. I said, why didn't you laugh at that? I thought that was so funny.
You said that?
Yeah. And I said, well, let me try this one and see if you'll laugh at this. And
very
then,
honest.
Then, yeah, well, that was my... I like to be honest.
Yeah.
So I guess that's why Chris thought it was funny. It wasn't because I was writing anything at that point.
Right.
But I could just see.
You just couldn't understand?
How is this not working? This is supposed to be so good, and I had it in my head, and it's not doing.
Well, that's better doing that than like just falling into yourself.
And my first heckler said, why don't you get a job or something? And I said, well, I don't even have a response to that. Because I'm so new at this, so come back later, another time, and maybe I can answer with something very, very witty.
How'd that do?
It was good.
Yeah.
But anyway, so then I get, and then there's another comedian, a female comedian, called Carol Siskind.
I know Carol
Siskind. Yes, who is a very funny comedian.
She's still around. I don't think she does stand-up anymore.
Well, she was still very good friends with Silver.
Yeah.
And I just could not get on at the improv. And Silver just hated me. And she came over to me once and said, I can't put you on anymore because of your voice. And I said, what do you mean?
She's wanted to talk.
I said, what do you mean? She said, you have a bad comedy voice.
Ugh.
And unless you go take voice lessons and you can't. So I said, well, the only problem I have, Silver, is people are laughing at what, because I was getting better.
Yeah.
And people are laughing at what I was, because I also went to all the, you know, the places where they had microphones and they were restaurants
open
and the
mics.
Bars, open mics, everywhere. So one night Bill Maher is there and he said, you know, you're really funny and Silver is really being mean to you. Come over to Catch a Rising Star and I will put you on.
This is like 82?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Bill was the first one. He still says, I was the one.
Yeah.
So he let me on at Catch a Rising Star, and then I stopped going to the improv because I couldn't take the abuse anymore.
Yeah. I mean, Silver was rough because when I was in New York in the late 80s, you know, it was sort of the last days of that place.
Mm.
And she was still, you know, pretty tough. I mean, she liked me, but, you never knew what you were going to get.
She didn't like me one little bit.
It's funny about Bill Maher because Bill Maher is with comics is pretty loyal and a good audience. Like
he's such a good laugher.
Yeah, he really
it's
a rare thing after a certain point with comics, but he loves to laugh.
And he does.
If he likes a comic, he'll laugh. He'll sit there and laugh.
Yeah, I haven't seen him for a really, really long time.
Oh, really?
But we used to hang out all the time in the days.
So Catch Rising Star, tell me about that because that was the club.
It was.
But did you do Dangerfields and stuff?
Yeah, Dangerfields too, yeah.
Who was hosting then?
Rodney gave me my first break. When I was on Rodney Dangerfield's Young Comedian Special.
Oh, you were on the one, the big one in 85, right?
The one with
Sam Kinison
and
Saget
Louis. Yeah, and I was on that one.
Louis Anderson,
yeah.
Who I just saw the other night. Who's like, he's had this career resurgence.
I know, it's amazing.
He's so thrilled. He's such a sweet guy.
Yes, we've been friends forever.
Well, I imagine you would like his work because he's
we
very...
We work together a lot. We're on the road together a lot, yeah.
Very Jack Benny.
Yes, exactly.
So at that time, Catch a Rising Star, so what is that the era of, you know, Larry David, Mark Schiff, or Mark Schiff's the comic strip. Who was?
Mark Schiff was there all the time. Yeah. Jerry Seinfeld, Bill Maher, Ronnie Shakes, Pat Benatar. In fact, I was on the first, maybe this was before Ronnie Dangerfield, I was on one with Andy Kaufman. It was the Catch a Rising Star 10th anniversary special.
Oh, wow.
And they gave me 3 or 4 minutes introducing the new young comedian, Rita Rudner, even though I wasn't so young because I already had a different career. But it was a very big thing that I was supposed to go on after Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And the producer came in, her name was Pat. And she said, I'm going to sneak you on before Andy because I don't know what the audience is going to be like after Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And she let me go on before Andy, and I did really well. And it's true, if I would have gone on after Andy Kaufman, because he did a big thing with somebody heckling him from the audience,
right.
And the audience didn't know if it was real or not, and everybody became unsettled because that was what he did.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was very lucky.
Did you, who were you hanging out with? Who were your pals?
My big pal was a very, very funny woman named Marjorie Gross.
Oh, I don't know if I know her.
Oh, the funny. She was my first writing partner. I just loved her. She passed away too. Isn't that sad? And we would write together all the time. Fred Stoller.
Stoller's around.
Yeah. I used to write with Stoller.
I see Stoller. Do you talk to Stoller?
No, because, you know, I'm a mother and a wife and I live in Las Vegas. And I have a whole different thing where I am now.
Sure, of course.
But I used to hang out a lot with Bill.
Yeah.
And I was just one of the guys. Anyone who had a joke book, Gilbert.
Yeah.
We would just sit there with our joke books all
the
time.
At the diner or something?
No, I never went to the diner because I always went from club to club to club to club.
Right.
I would never hang out at the diner.
No, two in the morning diner.
No, I had to go back. I had to be at ballet class by 10.
You were still doing that?
Yeah. I just go to ballet class by 10.
But it was, when you look back on it, when I think about my crew, who I started with, those were great times.
Oh, I loved it. Are you kidding? Yeah. My first job with Jerry Stanley, and we would go out and we would be in the car. I said it was always two comedians who were funny and then the comedian who wasn't good but who had the car.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And driving to Jersey.
Driving to Jersey, getting lost and people throwing peanuts at me, making $25. I loved it.
Did you feel like at that time you would get flack or a negative reaction because you were a woman?
I never really thought about it. I just wanted to write a good joke.
Right.
So,
and at the time you were starting out, did you feel that women were better represented or starting to get better represented? Because when you went into it, you were like, there's no women doing this.
There's still very few.
Right, of course.
But, you know, and also I didn't really concentrate on, am I a woman, am I a man?
Yeah.
I wanted to do jokes that would work whether I was, that's one of the things I noticed about Woody Allen. He did jokes that would work whether you were a woman or a man.
Yeah, the
so
jokes
I just
were their own
the
thing.
The jokes, I just wanted to write good jokes.
Right, so you weren't a rambly, let's explore kind of person. You kept it tight.
I would love to be one of those, but I can't do it. I tried. Jerry Seinfeld used to tell me, Rita, you're too compact. You're going to have to write too many jokes because you're not leaving any air. And I said, well, I try to leave air, but no one's laughing at the air.
Yeah, you have to make a much longer joke about nothing.
I know, and I tried, and I envy people who could do that, but I couldn't do it.
But you know, your style is more enviable. You watch somebody who are you watching? I was just watching someone the other night that when you do jokes, one-liners, either Rodney style or however you're going to go, you know, the fact that you can write so many of them, if you can fill an hour with that, it's much more impressive than me rambling on for 11 minutes about my cats.
Yeah, but that's a real talent, too.
Right.
Because that's something that I would aspire to do. George Carlin could do it really well, and he could expound on something and just make it bigger and bigger and bigger. And I don't have that personality. I've tried in my newest... The new special, the one that I just
Tale
did.
Tale of Two Dresses?
Yeah, to do jokes that have more more words in them.
But are they more personal?
They're always personal. I talk about raising a 16-year-old daughter and being married for 30 years.
Yeah.
And getting older and, you know, my hard time that all older people have with the social media things that are going on. And so I have to talk about things that are relevant, and that's what I talk about.
And you always did that, really, do you think?
Yeah, when I was dating, you know, I was single and I used to talk about boyfriends and I used to say, I remember I had one boyfriend who broke up with me because he didn't want to get involved. And I said, but I already have a joke about that. You know, I would like you to make up something else because this isn't helping my career. So,
so there was your joke.
So there was my joke, and I had to. You have to go along. I can't make jokes about anything else except what's happening in my life.
How many comics did you date before you stopped that?
One. Uno. That was enough of that.
Which one?
He passed away.
Oh,
everybody
sorry.
I touch. Yeah, so I can't even say.
Okay.
But only one.
Okay. So you did did you see Andy a lot?
Andy Kaufman?
Yeah.
No.
So he was already sort of out of it by the time you were in. But like Emo was around, right?
Oh, Emo and I was on the road with Emo.
That's what I kind of remember.
Emo and Larry Bud Melman and I went on a bus and truck tour of colleges. It was the greatest thing I've ever done.
Bud Melman was always disconcerting to me.
Oh, he was. I loved Larry Bud.
Yeah.
He would always, we were in the bus and we would be driving from one place to another. And every time we'd pass a Del Taco, he would want to go there and go, Mexican's nice. And we said, we don't want Mexican, Larry Bud. And then Emo would be stealing the coleslaw. He would coleslaw wherever we went.
Living on the edge, you guys.
It was really fun. And Emo, because I was an exerciseaholic, so Emo and I used to swim. We used to, when we were in a hotel, we were having swims. And he used to get out of the pool and say, Rita, I don't want to look too muscular because it won't go with my act. Am I looking muscular? I said, no, you're fine, Emo. No one's going to mistake you for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You know, he's returned back to the character.
Oh, has he?
Yeah, because he went through about a decade there where he wasn't, but now he's grown the hair out again and
he looks...
Okay,
want to hear my favorite Emo joke?
Yeah.
It always makes me laugh. I got some new underwear today. Well, new to me. Isn't that a great joke?
It's a good joke.
Okay, here's my favorite Larry David joke because he had the best opening joke. He was in the clubs too. When I was there, he used to go on stage. You know how Larry David looks. You know, I'd like to say a word about good-looking people. We're not well-liked. It's one of my favorite jokes. Aren't these great jokes?
Did you see him lose his mind a couple of times on stage? Did he?
Oh, yeah. He would berate the audience.
All the time, right?
Oh, and then Richard, there was another guy, Richard, who would berate the audience. He was really funny, though. I can't remember his last name. Not Belzer. Anyway, he used to go, the audience wouldn't laugh, and he used to go, there's nothing lower than an audience. It goes, crayfish audience. And he would leave.
Wasn't that the best about being a comic back then, before you had to be worried about people tweeting about or whatever?
I know.
They would lose their mind sometimes.
That's the thing that I would love for my daughter, because it's a thing that I've always been lucky enough to have, was something I love to do.
Yeah.
I loved Broadway when I was on Broadway, and I love comedy when I'm doing comedies. And if you have something you love to do, I think you're going to be okay.
It's amazing, like, when you're a comic, you don't think about it anymore, but how much time you spend in those rooms watching people go do that. Just stand up there.
Yeah.
Like hours and hours.
But that's your education.
Yeah, but it's also great. Like, especially if you like watching, you know, certain people.
Yeah, now then, but like my husband, because he sees me do these acts. So, but he doesn't come with me a lot. But if he does, the only time he'll laugh is if I say a joke that doesn't work. I say a new joke.
No, that's comics are like that.
Yeah, and he'll just sit there and go.
Yeah, it's not even a real laugh. Yeah. It's like an acknowledgement.
Oh, I love that. I was on the road a lot with Dennis Miller. Hey, Rita, are you going to do the one about the holistic dry cleaner tonight? I said, no, Dennis, thank you for reminding me.
It bombed.
Oh, bombed badly. I don't even know
what it was.
I can't remember.
Oh, you can't.
No, something about going to a holistic dry cleaner. I thought that was funny in itself, and the audience just stared at me like I was from Mars.
So in the 80s, like, you were like a big act.
I tried
to be. On the road. Like when you did the tour with Louis Anderson, was that like the two of you co-headlining kind of thing?
Yeah,
Dennis?
Yeah.
Right, uh-huh. So like, because I remember those. They do these two headliner shows.
Oh, yeah, all the
and
time.
And travel a bit. Because I remember Louis used to do it with Roseanne sometimes.
Yeah, I did it after Roseanne.
Right. And so
I did Vegas with Louis a lot, too, and Vegas with Dennis a lot.
So after the Dangerfield thing, when do you think you became sort of capable of doing the hour, of doing those bigger shows, of drawing?
Well, then I kind of went like, I do every rung, you know?
Yeah.
So I start with the improv where you do, 12 shows a night and you get paid $2.
Right.
And then that was in Vegas. And then my career kind of blossomed little by little, but I could tell from Vegas.
Vegas.
So I went, and then Jeff Altman... I remember I was on TV.
A big butt steak.
Yeah. I was on Flip You Like or something.
Yeah, Flip You Like a cheeseburger.
Yeah, cheese almond.
Oh, shit.
So I went and I started being on the Letterman show a lot, and that kind of got me a bigger audience. And
you had a good relationship with Dave.
I never knew him personally, but he would have me on the show quite a bit. And Bob Morton used to have me on the show all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Like in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I went to Los Angeles. Yeah. And then I couldn't get on the Tonight Show.
I lived here.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I couldn't get on the Tonight Show because Jim McCauley hated me.
Ugh.
And I auditioned him for about 5 years.
You auditioned for him for 5 years?
Yeah. And then
after you'd done Letterman, like 10 times.
Oh, yeah.
What an ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he, every time I would get on stage, he would walk out until Alex Friedman, Bud's wife, said, "What is your problem? This is a very funny woman. You have to listen to her." So he stayed in.
Yeah.
And he listened to me and said, "Okay, I'll let you on the show, but you have to totally rearrange your material." And
what does that mean? Order-wise?
Yeah. And he said, I want you to do this, 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 and this. And he said, "Also, do you know who Mary Lou Retton is?" This is true. This is what he said. And I said, "Yeah, she's a gymnast. Look at her timing." I said, "She's on a board flipping backwards. What do you mean?" He said, "She's got good timing. You have to look at her time." Oh, what? He'd been drinking, you know, because he used to drink. So he said, "Tomorrow night, let's go see you at the Hermosa Comedy and Magic Club."
Yeah.
So I said, "Okay." So I do his, I rearrange it, and it's uncomfortable because it's not coming from me.
Right.
And it's a mess.
But do they do that, though? The producers, they tell you, you know, "Oh, close with this or do this."
Yeah.
You're doing 8 minutes, right?
Well, so I don't know. I remember it was a mess, and I couldn't remember what came. And I said, so he came up to me, to his credit, and said, "It was better the way you did it." And he gave me a shot.
Did you do a backflip or dismount?
You know, I watched Mary Lou Retton. It made all the difference. So I go and I'm on the Tonight Show, and Johnny really liked me and then kept having me on all the time.
That's great.
And that was really good.
You got in under the wire.
I did, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was very nice to me. I mean, because he was a shy guy. And
Johnny.
And he used to come in and even say hello to me in the makeup room you know, "How's your day?" and everything. So he was very sweet to me.
So you did both Letterman and Johnny like a couple dozen times between the two of them.
Yeah.
So you come out here, so you're good. You're doing good. You're building more. Like, so I imagine you're doing Carson. At that time, that would make a big difference at the club or wherever you were going to be.
Yeah, and I started getting HBO specials. I got my own specials. And
what was the first special?
My own or with somebody else?
No, your own. Did you do
my
one
own for- was Rita Rudner. I know that bit of it. It was something about mild.
Born to be
born
mild.
Born to be mild. Oh, yeah. That born to be mild. That was it.
Yeah.
And then I did Married Without Children.
Both for HBO?
Yeah.
Those are big. That's big.
Yeah. And then, but I did loads of things in between, the Women of the Night special and One Night Stand special.
Yeah.
And then one in New York that I can't remember the name of. It was the Madison Square Garden special. And I said, loads of little specials where I was in.
You're working, you're making good money on the road.
Uh-huh.
And you did some TV acting here and there throughout? No.
No. No, I finally got some a pilot script deal.
Yeah.
And a pilot.
In the late 80s?
Probably.
Yeah.
And it was good and didn't get picked up. And then I got a script deal.
Yeah.
And this one I wrote with another girl whose name is Wendy Goldman, who's a really funny comedy writer.
Yeah.
And it was very good. It was called Dames, and it was about the young Golden Girls and three divorced women living together in Chicago.
Spinsters?
No, we were divorced.
Okay.
Oh, is that a spinster if you're divorced?
I don't know. I just thought I'd call back the word spinster.
Okay, I like that spinster.
Thank you.
So, and Les Moonves was the head of CBS.
The disgraced Les Moonves.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. He didn't like a show called Dames. So, about people bitching about men.
Uh-huh.
So he didn't pick it up.
Wow. In light of the recent...
I know.
Makes sense.
Yeah, the Him Too movie.
You're probably lucky that he didn't like it.
I don't know. Yeah. But he didn't like it, didn't put it on, and it was really funny. We did a big presentation of it at the Comedy Store, the one that's on Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
And we did a whole where I had Bob Saget, my friend Bob Saget was in it, and two other women who were so funny, and it like killed.
Yeah.
And
you did a table read?
A table read, part acting, part.
Uh-huh.
And they passed before I could get to the parking lot.
That's no reason, right?
It's just not for us.
Uh-huh.
You're very talented, not for us.
Ugh.
So this is when my husband and I.
When did you marry that guy?
I married him. Well, he came in to Catch a Rising Star one night. because he had jet lag and he was looking at shows. He was a producer in Australia. And
that's what I heard. I remember like there was like some point in your career where like I was like, what happened to Reed Rudner? And they were like, I think she went to Australia.
Yeah, I did. I went to Australia.
And I was like, is that a thing people do? And Jeff Stilson.
Yeah. Remember Martin was the person bringing all the comedians to Australia.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
So he's looking for shows.
A Catch a Rising Star. Yeah. And he says, well, she's funny. And he hires me to do the Edinburgh Festival first. Because in England, why are you going, ugh, you don't like that?
The Edinburgh Festival was not good for me. It's turned into quite a clusterfuck. Maybe when you did it.
Oh, no.
It was just sort of like 9 people a night. There was 1,000 shows going on simultaneously.
Okay.
But maybe when you do it, there was a more...
Well, I did it 100 years ago, so it was a long time. It must have been... 35 years. Well, my gosh, 35 years ago.
Wow.
My gosh.
What was the festival like? Just 2 venues? I mean,
it was still a lot, but it wasn't
1,000.
It wasn't 1,000, and there weren't many comedy shows.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, so I start working for him. I'm not, no relationship or anything, but he keeps calling me and saying, because I had a boyfriend in New York at that point, I didn't want to go anywhere. And one day he called me up and said, I have a new show I'm doing in Australia. I moved from England to Australia. Please come. Because he'd done it a year before and I wouldn't go because I'm my boyfriend.
What kind of new show? Like a...
What did he want to do?
Was he doing stage shows?
Oh, it was a new theater that he wanted to open up on the Gold Coast in Australia.
Yeah.
Which is like the Hawaii of Australia.
Right.
And he calls up, and at that point I just had a huge fight with my boyfriend. And it
perfect
was Christmas time. And I said, I'm not going to sit here and be miserable about this stupid guy. So I went to Australia and for Christmas. And I'd known him for years by then, like 2-3 years.
Yeah.
And I moved in. And that was that.
That was that?
Yeah.
And you lived in Australia?
For a while, yeah. A long time. I mean, I'd go back and forth and spend a lot of time in Australia.
Mm-hmm. But was it, that was primarily for the relationship, not because comedy was so good in Australia?
Both.
You became a big star in Australia.
I did lots of television in Australia. I mean, not a big star, but I did. I played theaters.
I think if you hang around long enough in Australia, you get on TV, right? I mean,
yeah, not really, but yeah. But it is a smaller marketplace. It is.
Sure. No, yeah. I know. I've performed there, and I've noticed that about like even England, that because of the sort of size of the media landscape there, if you're good, you're going to get on and maybe get a show and be regulars. And
it gets increasingly more difficult as time goes on.
Uh-huh.
But at that point, I did get a lot of TV exposure in Australia.
And so you must have been generating a lot of material.
I try. I always try.
Right.
I never know when it's going to come out or not, but I keep trying.
But because like there were like did what am I wrong that Jeff Stilson lived in Australia? Did he live in Australia? Do you know him?
Yeah, of course I know Jeff Stilson. Yeah,
he was there, right?
My husband brought him there, and Richard Jenny and Larry Amorose. I know my friend Richard
Jenny.
But
did Stilson stayed though? Didn't he marry an Australian?
He could have done. I think he did. Yes, I think he did. You're right.
Yeah. He was very funny.
But my husband, when we got together, I said, you know, I'm not going to live in Australia.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I can do my show from my job from anywhere. I produce shows. There's a phone. And he moved to Los Angeles with me.
So you're both in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're touring you're touring solo, but then you talk about Vegas. Now, I haven't talked to a lot of people who have had the experience you've had in Las Vegas. Because like for me, the type of comedy I do, I somehow avoid Las Vegas. But I know that if you get a residency in Las Vegas, that is where you can really sustain a high quality of life, a good living, and you know, perform forever. How do you enter that world? Was that for your husband producing, or how'd that work?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's step by step. First, the improv, then me. They wouldn't have a female headliner.
The improv
with no
in
man.
Vegas.
Yeah. Then they wouldn't have a woman with no man. So it was me and Jeff Altman at the Sands. Then I got a contract at the Sands.
To do your own show at a room.
Louis. Yeah, but it was the Copa room with me. Louis and I used to do it. Louis
like
Anderson.
How many weeks? Like, you know,
like 8 weeks a year or something, back and forth. Then I started opening for Julio Iglesias and, you know, people in that Caesars.
Who else do you open for?
A lot of Sergio's.
Yeah.
Sergio, I remember their first name was Sergio. Yeah.
I always notice about billboards for Action Las Vegas. I'm like, who is that?
Well, this now it's
one
all
name.
Yeah, now it's all DJs.
DJs, so right? You
know,
just
Diplo.
See these signs.
I don't know who Diplo.
Yeah, yeah, just
and,
like
you Mousehead.
Johan. It's yeah. like, who is that guy with the haircut?
Who's
on
Marshmallow? I don't know. So anyway, so I go and then I go step by step by step, and then Dennis and I are at the MGM. Louis and I are at Bally's
for like 8 weeks, 12 weeks.
Yeah, a year
spread out.
And it's every. I notice every time I go to Vegas yeah. with Martin. We have a great time.
Uh-huh.
The audiences are good. I come out with a lot of money. We're happy. Then I go back to Los Angeles and I get my head kicked in.
You're just another one of the people.
And my scripts are, well, not Martin and I wrote movie scripts that sold very, very well.
Oh, yeah?
But,
like which ones?
Well,
they get made?
They didn't know. They never get made.
But you did. You wrote
but
the scripts.
We sold specs yeah. and
oh, great.
We did really well.
So you're
but
doing
it was
that.
A. Well, I'm having meetings with these movie executives and yeah. my head is hurting.
Yeah.
And the last one, Martin and I rewrote Green Acres.
Uh-huh.
And we pitched this thing to Green Acres.
That got made, didn't it?
No, it never got made. And because it's the thing that's going on with the revivals
yeah.
and everything.
Right.
And I said, you know, we're going to pitch this of who we're going to do it for.
Yeah.
And we're going to do an outline and she's going to approve it.
Yeah.
And we're not going to take any chances. We're going to get because, you know, these people, they're so mean when
yeah.
you go in and you're writing and writing and writing. I don't like it. I don't like this. I don't like that.
And
do
who the
it
hell
again.
Are they?
You know,
yeah.
I said, well, you do it.
Yeah.
I'm getting mean,
yeah.
you know. So I go in and this woman is so mean to us about this script. And I'm sitting there with my arms crossed and I won't even take my sunglasses off. And I said, you approved everything with, and Martin said, how, you know, he's usually the one that goes on. And I said, I just can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
This is too upsetting.
Yeah.
So I got this call to work a little room in Las Vegas at the MGM that they didn't know what to do with, the Catch a Rising Star room.
In oh, yeah, I remember.
At
yeah.
the MGM.
Yeah.
Because the Crazy Horse Girls were coming and they were negotiating and uh-huh. the contract wasn't coming together. Did 6 weeks there, sold out, turned into 6 months.
Yeah, at Catch.
Yeah. We renamed it. Martin renamed it. It was called the something theater. I'm not
sure. So they got rid of Catch.
Oh, yeah. They got rid of Catch and replaced it with me.
But that was when Rich Fields had sort of opened a bunch of Catches everywhere, right?
Yeah.
For a minute?
Yeah.
yeah.
But then it was a game show after that they did there. And so anyway, Martin renames it the Palace. I forget what it is.
Yeah.
So then they offered to build me my own theater at New York, New York.
Wow.
And it was a big decision. And Martin and I, we were doing well. We were writing scripts. I was still getting jobs on the road. And
did you do other writing? Did you write for the Oscars?
I did 3 years. I wrote for the Oscars with Steve Martin
was
and
that
Whoopi
great?
Goldberg. Oh, I love Steve Martin.
Yeah.
He's one of my idols.
Nice and guy to you?
Really nice guy.
Oh.
He's one of my idols. And it was one of the all-time great experiences working with Steve. With Whoopi, I was already living in Las Vegas,
yeah.
so I didn't get the day-to-day things, even though Whoopi has always been wonderful to me as well.
Right.
But
so you got your own theater.
But Steve
yeah.
and we were always at his house writing. And it was
oh,
really
that's
fun.
Great.
Yeah. So we said, do we keep banging our heads against a wall here? You know,
yeah.
you don't want to go
in
to a
LA.
Party every day where no one likes you.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, it's like you creating your own thing here.
Yeah.
You get to do what you want to do all the time.
Right.
So Martin said, I will produce the show. We'll adopt a baby. We'll sell our house. We sold everything. We sold our dishes, our silverware, our couches,
uh-huh.
everything. And we just moved to Las Vegas. And I stayed there for 12 years or 13 years with my own show.
In your own theater?
6 years in my own theater.
Yeah.
And then I shifted from a Harrah's to the Venetian.
So when you do that, like, what is the week? You do what? Thursday, Friday, Saturday? What?
I did the first 6 years, I did 5-6 nights a week.
For how many weeks a year?
All the time.
Wow.
I just, because Martin, because he's a producer, said, when you're making money, make
Keep.
All the money you can.
That's
because
right.
soon you won't be making any money.
He yeah.
said, I know this.
You have your window.
Yeah, this is your window.
Yeah.
So if there's sold out, I'm adding another show. And you will be happy you did this.
And also the great thing about Vegas is that, you know, if you are known to be a good show in Vegas, you know, people will go out of their way to see you, even if they might not know you or whatever. But like, if you want to see something funny, this is where you go.
But also we got in at the right time. Again, so much of life is timing. When we went, There were there was one Cirque show just opening over at the Mirage.
Cirque du Soleil show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were against, we called it, it was Lord of the Dance. We called it Lord in My Pants.
Yeah.
And we, yeah. it was Lord in My Pants yeah. at the big theater and uh-huh. an EFX show, which was at the MGM, which wasn't very good. And so there wasn't a lot of competition. Martin noticed that there weren't a lot of comedians there.
Who was there, comedian-wise?
There weren't any comedians.
Doing then. Residencies like that,
no,
really?
No, nobody.
Not yet.
No, he created that. And he said, we're going to create this one. He said, I'm going to build you a smaller theater. It had 400 seats.
Yeah.
So you can do it every night instead of these thousands of, you know,
yeah.
things.
Right.
So, and then create an existence. And also, I do charities whenever I can where I live. But
yeah.
I did loads of work, you know, and my dog was in the show, too. My sheep, Ina, the sheepdog.
Yeah.
And he did charity work too. He was on billboards for other dogs.
All in Vegas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you so,
and we were able to raise a little girl.
Yeah.
And I would go to work at 7, be home by 10. No more traveling.
Yeah.
And it was great.
And it you don't live there anymore?
I live there part time. Yeah, I live there a lot of the time as well. Now I'm negotiating a new contract with another male headliner at a different casino.
Which
but
headliner?
I can't say because until it goes through. But like it would be fun.
One of your generation?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
And when you're there as a performer, because like, you know, the old Vegas, you kind of got the feeling that there was a real community there and everybody hung out. But it doesn't seem like that was the Vegas you were in.
I don't ever do that. You know, I did it when I was single.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like a
sure.
mother. You know,
right.
I have my friends' daughters' mothers, and I,
oh, okay.
you know,
yeah.
I'm just, I have a different lifestyle now.
But when did the other comics start coming in, doing what you were doing?
So I'm doing the MGM, the little room at the MGM, and I get a call from my old friend George Wallace.
Oh, yeah, he's like, yeah.
He loves Vegas. And he said, how'd you get that room? And I said, I created it.
Yeah.
My uh-huh. husband and I built it.
Uh-huh.
I want that room. I said, okay, well, you're going to have to get your own room, George.
Yeah. And he did.
So then he did. And then Carrot Top.
He's at the
came in Luxor.
Luxor, yeah.
Yeah. And he has his residency there now. And then it just started, you know, then I think word got out that you can make a really good living and you don't have to get on a plane every day.
So that's something that happened in the 90s, you're saying, basically.
No, 2000. I started in the year 2001.
Wow. So that whole thing, like, I mean, like a lot of comics, I mean, a handful of people that can do it.
Mm.
Some comics have rooms there that they book. I mean, what's his name? Had that one that people do, but it's not a residency, but it was, he booked it. The guy from the Sopranos.
Oh, right. Yes, I know him. He was
Sharippa,
really nice.
Sharippa.
Yeah, Sharippa.
Yeah.
Oh, how funny was Steve Sharippa.
Yeah, but he booked a room.
Yeah,
somewhere.
I remember he was at the Desert Inn.
Yeah.
I remember. And he used to come in and have the shrimp. And the shrimp is very good. Shrimp on a stone.
Yeah, and Sandy, like, well, I talked to Sandy because I was, you know, I loved his father. You know,
yeah.
And I was curious about his life. And he, I guess it was long before you were there, but, you know, he used to sort of carry on that old tradition of having a variety show in a little hotel and booking things here.
I have to tell you, one of my biggest epiphanies
mm-hmm.
was Sandy Hackett invited, I just had moved to Los Angeles, and he had a big party at Buddy Hackett's house
yeah.
in Beverly Hills.
Uh-huh.
And all the comedians came, and there was a pool and a waterfall
yeah.
and a gorgeous, and I said, oh my gosh, jokes built this house.
Yeah.
I'm going to write a lot of jokes because I want a really nice house.
That happened at Buddy Hackett's house?
Yeah.
Did you know Buddy?
I met him, but I
yeah.
knew Sandy mostly.
Yeah, yeah.
And but I just remember, just write a lot of jokes, Rita, and you can have a big, nice
you
house.
You can have a nice, and yeah. you did it.
And I did it. I wrote a lot of jokes, have a nice house.
Well, it sounds like your life is great.
It's pretty good, I have to say.
And this new special you did with Comedy
Dynamics?
Yeah.
Yes.
When it drops, when?
It's now. It has just dropped, and it's dropping as we speak. I
wow.
can feel it dropping.
People, yeah.
Yeah. And it's called Rita Redner, Tale of Two Dresses. And my daughter is at the end because she's a singer-songwriter, and she's really good. And I don't know, now she wants to be a policeman, but who knows?
Oh, yeah. You just let her explore.
You'll be a musical policeman.
Yeah, we need more musical policemen.
She likes forensics. What am I going to do? She's
yeah.
going to be a CSI musician.
So, and this is available to download on iTunes. And
I iTunes and Schmytunes.
Yeah. Oh, that's
also on Schmytunes.
That's only available in Florida.
Yeah, that's good. That's in Schmytunes. And it's in, Google, it's on demand.
Yeah, you can demand it.
You demand it and then it comes to you. If you demand it, it will come.
Okay. Great talking to you, Rita.
Thank you for having me on your lovely show.
It was great. It was
I hope everything is good. And I'm looking at a hammer and some dice.
Yeah, a lot of stuff here.
And a cat, on a
mosaic
mushroom. Okay, yeah. I'm just saying, this is my favorite thing. I don't know what that's
exercise.
Going.
And I'm
going
to give you a nice mug to commemorate our time together.
Oh, I love a mug. I'm a coffee girl.
All right. That was Rita Rudner. Great comic. Her comedy special, A Tale of Two Dresses, is now available on digital and on-demand platforms. You can also check out RitaRudner.com to see where she's performing around the country. And don't forget, there are a few tickets left to my Saturday night show at the Beacon in New York City. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for the ticket link. And if you're at the Beacon show, you'll have the first chance to buy the new WTF Draplin design t-shirt. And that's it. I'm going to go out into the day here, the beautiful day in New York. Vote, please. Please, will you? Could you just do it? I did it. You can do it. Try to do the right thing. Do the right thing, can you? I'm going to go wander the streets. And by the way, I'm recording this on Sunday, so, you know, don't think it's Monday and I'm wandering around. But it doesn't matter. I'm meeting Todd Barry for lunch. We're going to walk around and talk about what we always talk about. Boomer lives!